Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Deep Dive with me, Stephen. Otelli is unfortunately not feeling well this week, so she's taking a rest at home. Now, just a quick shout out to our listeners and viewers. You know, we've had a bit of a spirited debate online about a recent episode we did on AI in education. A lot of people, you know, sort of sharing about their views about whether we should be using AI when it comes to school. And then we recently did one about AI and how it's being used for scams as well. So if you want to catch up on those episodes, do find us on YouTube. Otherwise, wherever you listen to your usual podcasts. But tech is one of those things we can't live without, and AI is very much a part of it today. So today is more AI talk, but a more serious setting, because recently the Ministry of Home Affairs released a Singapore terrorism threat assessment. In this report, a couple of things stood out. One, there's a growing diversity of extremist ideologies in Singapore. And two, that AI is being used as a terror enabler. So that's what we want to talk about today. How is AI enabling radicalization? And what are the challenges in monitoring such activities? So help us understand, how exactly is AI being used by extremist groups today to further their goals? Notwana?
In terms of the groups themselves, they're just using AI, just like how many other organizations are using it. Mm-hmm. Is basically to feed the information to those who are searching for some, perhaps, you know, data or information or even videos or images on extremist behaviors. And they use that to kind of, you know, make it a little bit more accessible, a lot faster. You don't have to search anymore because the AI can just, you know, kind of like document all these things and then give you what you want. And they're also manipulating this using the emotion. So if you feel sad about a cause and then they try to feed that using, you know, something else that would result in you wanting to take action to prevent that particular incident from happening, for instance.
So in the past, it was literally a website that I would go to search for information. But AI, you're saying, is able to personalize that experience?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. And bring it a little bit more faster, more accessible, you know, pull everything together and give it to you.
Give me an example.
An example would be if, let's say, I'm feeling sad about a cause that's happening or some incident that's happening in other parts of the world, and I'm searching for something, for instance, the incident in the Middle East, and I'm feeling a bit upset about it, the feed will just keep on giving me this information so that I would continue to feel sad. And then subsequently, the terror groups might use this opportunity to kind of feed in, you know, information that could make you feel like I can do something about it.
And I guess it does it a bit at a time. It's sort of a subtle echo chamber, you know, and it starts feeding you information to make you feel a certain way. I mean, Kenneth, do you find that too? Are these extremist groups who are using AI, and have they discovered this niche in the way they can use it to influence behavior?
Right. I think definitely they have been using AI in very niche areas, very limited areas actually, but very effectively. So the concern that I personally have is the intersection between AI and social media, AI and, you know, chat apps, because one of the key areas, places where terrorists share their propaganda on its through social media, through chat apps as well. So there are three impacts. Firstly, increased access. For example, a propagandist could only speak in a certain language, but having AI allows them to translate their messages to multiple languages. That's one. Volume, as Prof. Raswana has mentioned as well. In the past, you know, it's very difficult, tedious to craft a propaganda message. Today, I can digest tons of messages and then generate contextually specific messages as well. And you mentioned before personalization with chatbots, for example. So Telegram, there are chatbots that can be trained to personalize the radicalization experience. So that's the three impacts of AI.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned a chatbot because we have an example I heard of where a 15-year-old Singaporean female, she took a virtual oath with a chatbot. Right. And after that, she pledged allegiance to ISIS just using that chatbot. I mean, what was it about that chatbot that made it so convincing that she would feel this way?
I think it's, like you said, it takes time. It's a progressive, you know, kind of influence. And she was very young as well. So she was looking for all these materials and information. And then she kind of like fell in love to some extent, you know, to the images of all this, so-called in her perspective, they were fighting for certain cause. And that kind of, you know, moved her into this direction. So it can be, it's not just the chatbot alone. Okay. It's the cumulative, you know, environment that she was in or the internet space. That kind of made her want to, you know, do this through the use of the chatbot.
So the chatbot became the official tool to formalize her allegiance.
Correct, yeah. But all this other information was pulled together because she was already in that space where she was looking for certain information and she felt, okay, this is something that I can do and this is what I want to do.
So, Kenneth, you talked about social media. I mean, all our young people on social media, you know, on Instagram, TikTok, Telegram, everything. So give us some examples. How is this being used to sort of shape their thinking and their behavior?
So there are several ways that AI could be used. So the traditional way that AI has been used by the terrorist group, it's to draft propaganda messages, draft images, for example, that appeals to the already converted, for example. So it accelerates the radicalization process. The other way to use AI is through deepfakes. So using deepfakes, there are multiple possibilities. I can perform necromancy, for example. So if there is a deceased terrorist that is very reputable, very legitimate, I can then use deepfake to then revive this individual to radicalize others.
Okay. And these are things that are popping up on their social media feeds. I mean, is there a way to sort of filter this, to look at this, you know? Because now you're saying anyone can do it, anyone can make it, right?
Yeah.
The tools are so accessible. So what then should we be doing?
The way I see the problem is that it's not technology, it's ideology. So in essence, with or without AI, the process of radicalization remains the same. So there is the us versus them narrative. Yeah. There is the intolerance against the other, regardless of ideology. Mm-hmm. So the key to dealing with AI, it's not just establishing frameworks to ensure that there are guidelines and ethical standards for AI. It's not just monitoring the social media space, but also to educate the community so that we are more resilient against these messages.
Okay, but you say with or without AI, so you're saying it's not so much the technology, you know, but the technology definitely makes it a lot easier for them to reach their targets.
Yes. So if you look at the evolution of, let's say, criminology, the theories of crime and why people, you know, indulge in certain behaviours. And in this case, when you look at radicalization, I mean, for one person, it could be a freedom fighter. For the other person, it's a terrorist or a traitor. It's just perception. So I think if you are able to train the individual to be able to be a bit more discerning, to have a little bit more tolerance, I think especially the younger generation, there's just too much information for them.
Okay.
And they're getting the information in snapshots without going in depth, you know, to really look at where is this information coming from. They don't have any data to justify that. In fact, they're not even able to think that way because they are young. So in that context, then they are being somewhat manipulated, you know, to kind of move into this direction towards, you know, trying to embrace a little bit more of an open ideology for us to be able to go into this radicalized way of, you know, highlighting our cause, even if there is no reason for them to be able to do that. So if you look at like some of the cases that we have had here, we live in Singapore, there are so many other opportunities for young people, and yet, you know, they felt that this is what I need to do. I want to be, you know, married to this group of people. Okay. So I think things like that, yeah.
But when you say, you know, teach our people to be more discerning, that's actually very difficult.
It is.
Right? I mean, and we talk about artificial intelligence. I've done shows where, I mean, I show you a video, you have no idea whether it's real or fake. So how can they, or how can we be discerning?
I would think that if we are able to at least have certain stop measures, you know, when we're looking at certain things, for the younger ones, I feel that we can do more. We can do more by not giving them the accessibility to all the social media, you know, influence. At least not when they're so young, you know.
Okay, so what age then, people will be saying?
I think there is a lot of debate on this, you know, in terms of what will be the ideal age. You know, Australia's trying to ban young people. Yeah, in fact, they're going to go ahead with that, you know, end of the year. In fact, they're even put in YouTube as one of the, you know, service providers or platform providers. However, I would think that if we are able to get these young people to be able to have at least a sense of belonging to what they're doing, being involved in schools, I think all of those activities would kind of let them know, okay, there are other opportunities for me. I need not necessarily go into this path. Because what we know is when you start searching for certain things, like I'm feeling lonely or I'm feeling sad, you know, then the AI is like, you know, they are able to look at, it's a bit like you want to go on a tour and you're looking for certain things, right? So they look at your emotions, and then with this emotion, then they are able to feed you things that, that you need, that you can connect with.
Okay.
And then that's how you get, you know, sucked into the whole, you know, episode.
It's almost like an algorithm where I want to buy a new bicycle, then suddenly I get all these bicycle ads telling me about the latest bikes and you know, things like that.
Exactly. But for adults, we are able to know, you know, where to buy the bike, you know, what kind of bike we want. But for young people, they're not able to do that because of their, you know, challenges in terms of delaying their gratification, right? Because they're young.
Right, right.
You know, and I think that is one of the reasons why we need to kind of find ways to prevent or stop accessibility, you know, until they are at the age where they can choose what they want.
But at the same time, Kenneth, I mean, our young people are perpetually online. I mean, not just our young people. I mean, I am guilty too of, you know, getting online quite a bit. So how can we do this then? Rizwan has mentioned that some of these who are a bit more isolated. Mm-hmm. So is it also a specific group who tend to not be part of the larger social community?
So that's a very good observation. I believe that it's a slightly different view, but I believe that the way to deal with technology and radicalization is offline. There's no way we can, you know, prevent the spread of technology, for example.
Yep.
I'll use an analogy. So if there's a forest fire and the wind is blowing and accelerating the spread of fire, do we block the wind or do we extinguish the fire? So if we use this analogy, then AI is like the wind, and then the ideology, the radicalizing mechanism, is the fire. So it's important for us to deal with the ideology itself. We can have stopgap measures for AI, having ethical guidelines to check AI companies in their role, having social media watchdogs. But if there's a will, there's a way. If I'm a motivated actor, I will find ways to, you know, bypass these firewalls to access this anyway. So in that sense, the ability to socialize, to social mix communities such that we build resilience, not just among the adults, but also from young in schools, I think it's very, very important.
So you're saying do this offline. In a way, okay, we can have measures to help maybe slow down the wind, but to really put out the fire, you're saying we have to find the source of the fire first.
Yes.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay. And in this case, in a real world scenario, what would that mean? As in reaching out to our young people?
I've seen some of these videos, right? You can see the sense of limitation in them. You know, they feel so proud in being part of this group. So I'm looking at these young people, maybe they feel so isolated. They don't feel belong to any groups, maybe in school, or it could be even to their own parents, they're not able to speak up.
Yeah.
So all these emotions and this underlying cause is the one that's pushing them into this direction.
Oh, so it's almost like they're joining a gang.
It's a bit like that. You know, like those days when we had the street corner gangs and all that. You go and play pool, you go, you know, they used to have those gangs
that's right.
But that was in a physical space and you can take a look at it. But this is online and parents are not able to observe what are the groups that they are in. So it's the same thing when it comes to gaming. You belong to a gaming community. This can be, you know, a typical soccer group that you're belonging to. But within that gaming community, you not only have members who could be promoting, you know, violent extremism ideology, but you also have the game makers who are, you know, promoting such things sometimes.
So you're saying some of these perhaps online games that a lot of the kids play nowadays could be subtly introducing these ideas into the game so that when the young people play with it, they unknowingly start believing those ideas.
Yeah. But to begin with, they are already searching for avenues to belong to. That's why they're going to such things, you see. I mean, I agree with Kenneth in terms of like what we need to do in terms of getting people to be, you know, able to mix and all that, you know, in terms of race and religion and all. But I think there is something that's missing in these young people that we need to look at. You know, what is it that want them to have this instant gratification? Why is it that they're not able to go to their parents if they feel sad or lonely? Why is it that they're turning to all these social medias to look at the amount of likes that they have? Something is really missing here. They're not able to share this with their friends in school or, you know, we know from the report, even friends who know or parents who know they are a bit more apprehensive in even coming forward and seeking help. So there's something that is not quite right in the way that we are, you know, moving in this direction of even, you know, acclimatizing them to normal ways of seeking help, normal ways of, you know, going around finding groups of friends in the real world and not just in the, you know, web.
But one could argue that I could also physically go to a football game and meet a bunch of guys, and some of them could also be wanting to plan bad ideas and bad thoughts into my head. So, I mean, and you said, how do we deal with this? Because there is no way for us to really fix what goes on online, right? It's virtually impossible. We know that, right?
Yep. Maybe I can add on to this. So I think that, Steve, you're right in terms of this radicalization that happens offline as well. And in fact, in a lot of the countries that in our neighboring countries, Indonesia, Philippines, a lot of radicalization happens offline. That's because there is already an established group and this group are actively recruiting people. Therefore, radicalization can happen offline. I think beyond socialization, it's also social mixing, you know, the idea that it is important to meet people who have a different background from me to build that tolerance, to build that resilience against the us versus them ideology. Because ultimately, I think the way radicalizers radicalize others, it's always the same. It's the idea that you're isolated, you have a clear enemy, and therefore you have to attack that enemy. But if that defined enemy is my friend, it is very difficult to then make the first step to dehumanize my friend.
Radicalization isn't just about religious extremism, right? I mean, we saw this with the case of a 16-year-old who identified as a white supremacist.
I mean, we have also the differences. We have the incel groups, you know, and all that. There's violent extremism can happen in any context, right? Even in the real world, it could be through, you know, playing soccer and you get upset and angry. But I would think if you're able to teach from young this values of tolerance and being able to kind of, you know, understand and accept the other, and also not to problem solve through violent means. Sometimes they need clarification. Maybe they're not sure, especially the younger ones. I think it's very quick, you know. It's not like they know so much about, you know, white supremacy. They may not even know these terms, you know. They just have one hero or one model that they're following. And if we can have that opportunity for them to come forward and say, you know, I'm following this guy. I don't know whether this is the right thing to do. Maybe then we can, you know, guide them along and talk to them, you know, why is it that you think that you need to follow and what is it that you're, you know, apprehensive about?
I mean, if the makers of whatever, you know, Instagram and all that, they're not monitoring how it might be used, because of course you can create a fake profile and be whoever. How would they regulate that? How do you think they should, kind of?
Right. I think today they are trying to regulate and monitor. So if you can do this experiment, although I don't encourage, you post a radical content on Facebook and see how quickly they take it down. Within 48 hours, it will be taken down. But there are ways to circumvent this. So it's always a cat and mouse game. We have this idea called the balloon syndrome. You know, when you squeeze a part of the balloon, you know, air goes to somewhere else. So there's a learning competition between you know, governments, tech companies, and also the terrorist groups. So with that said, I think beyond just regulation, I think data sharing is important. What the social media companies are lacking right now is that they are not sharing data with the enforcement agencies. Without this data, I can take down content. The individual can just create a new account and continue posting content. So there's no cost to creating new content.
But how would you police AI chatbots? I mean, how would you police the AI personas that are all coming online nowadays?
We may not even know whether these terror groups is all of them are just AI. I mean, it can be programmed in that way for this whole group to be virtual, and yet they could be, you know, recruiting individuals, real people, to actually conduct real attacks. So that's highly possible that you can have a program like that. Again, it goes back to how do we prevent such, you know, materials or such information to be accessible? What kind of controls can we have within our laws? And also in terms of getting the social media, you know, it has to come out somewhere. The chatbot has to be released in certain platforms or introduced in certain ways. Can we get those people to be responsible as well? Okay. You know, like for instance, when you do advertising, the advertising companies sometimes should be responsible. right? Okay. What they are promoting and what they're doing, you see. So we have broadcasting, you know, rules and regulations as well. What you broadcast and what you publish. Newspapers have got that responsibility. So I think it's really going back to look at what will be my criteria, my guideline, and in what way can I prevent this information from being leaked out, you know? Or is there a way for me to kind of, you know, do a whistleblowing? Oh, I know this is happening. Can I report this to someone?
Okay.
Let me add to that as well. So I think chatbots, the artificial intelligence part of chatbots come from somewhere.
Yeah.
It is difficult to develop an independent AI, generative AI, to deliver that personalization and interactivity that we all seem to think of. So look at ChatGPT, for example. It took them a long way to get to where they are right now. DeepSeek, for example, as well. You know, it's not something that can be done overnight. So what the terrorists are probably using, it's off-the-shelf solutions as an engine for their chatbots. So that means that we could go to existing companies, OpenAI, for example, DeepSeek, for example, Gemini, to get them to look at their source code, look at the training materials, and figure out how then can they police their platforms better moving forward. Yeah.
And is this something that governments need to be doing? It sounds like it's the government's role who has to step in and say, hey, you guys got to control this.
Right. I would say governments, multiple governments.
Yes.
So not just Singapore, because Singapore is a small market, right? Yeah. We can impose these rules, but if I'm a huge tech company, I could just move on to another bigger market. So
we need
the international community to clamp down on this AI company.
Asking for the international community is like, you know, asking for the world to come to the table and say, hey, let's all agree on doing this, which we know, even with many other issues, does not often happen. So even if we regulate it within Singapore, we must accept that there could be other countries which are a bit more lax.
Or they don't have the resources.
Or don't even have the resources to do that.
And with VPN, it's very easy to access resources from beyond Singapore.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it sounds like AI is just an added tool and resource for the bad actors to use. And in a matter of time, they will learn the best way to use it for their own propaganda, right?
That's right.
They're already using it. They're already doing that because AI is getting better.
Yeah.
The more we feed information into all of this chatbots and, you know, systems, they're getting better and better and better. So I don't think it's going to stop. So what can we do is to at least, you know, work with the user, the people who are using the system.
Okay, so as we wrap up, maybe let's answer the question, what can we do? What would you tell to our listeners here? I mean, parents, teachers, you know, even co-workers, what can we do? How should we look at this?
I would think that it's really important to teach young people how to use, not just young people, anyone who's using all these systems to be able to have a good, what I would call a sense of citizenship. You know, that I'm part of this system, I'm contributing certain information, and this information can be used negatively by someone else. So if all of us have got this sense of responsibility, so it's a bit like those days in the past, we had several, you know, financial crises. Banks were doing things without certain regulation. We came up with rules, but rules alone could not stop things from happening. It was the individual who are in that bank, in that system, that's actually, you know, making that change.
Right.
So it's us that we need to all play a part, because at the end of the day, the social platform, the media, we are the one who's providing the information.
Yes.
They're not creating anything new, you know. It's it's us who are contributing to that system.
As I agree with Prof. Raswana, I think it's important to teach our young to disagree with dignity, disagree without dehumanizing. So the source of terrorism, the source of radicalization, it's the idea of us versus them. I have to defeat my enemy through violence. If we are able to build a society that's resilient, which is able to, you know, have tough conversations, disagree with each other, but yet, you know, respect the opponent, for example, that would then build our resilience towards radical ideology. So with or without technologies, with or without AI, with or without, you know, these games, we will be as a society more resilient against that.
Okay, and that is an attitude we can take not just towards such situations, but in real life, I mean, when we don't agree, we just agree to disagree and, you know, not turn to violence as a result.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
We hope you've all enjoyed the discussion. And of course, if you have any thoughts on this issue, I mean, this is something that's close to heart, and we know that With technology so much a part of our lives, it always gets increasingly difficult to know what is right and what is wrong, and to look out for our young people as well. Thanks to the team, Tiffany Ang, Junaini Johari, Joanne Chan, Saya Win, Ho Pei Ning, Nathaniel Fetovero, Shaza Dalila, and Alison Jenner. Video is by Hanida Amin. That's it for Deep Dive. We'll see you next week.